Your bottom line, your business bottom line, 100% is tied to the overall health of you and your entire team. Today's guest will coach us on how to get healthy personally, physically, including financially. Welcome to Decision Points. I'm Doug Hudson.
I'm Scott Wood.
And Spencer Nix is our guest health coach.
Yeah.
I'm fired up today because Scott said to me several months ago, Spencer, as long as you have a gym, Scott will work out at your gym. And I know few people who take health and physical fitness and life fitness more disciplined than Scott. So that's about as high a praise as I think Scott Wood can give somebody.
It means a lot. As long as Scott keeps coming, I'll keep the doors open.
Well, neither one of you can die then, so hang in there.
That's right.
He's got a few years on you, so you might have a gym longer than
I may be rolling in there with my walker one day, but I'll still be going.
But I have to tie that story, and obviously, you know, we had a little chit-chat before we just got started last night, and Spencer, this will give you a segue to say something. I was at Cooper Clinic, which is foundational in many people's mind and health and fitness, and at 6:30, I'm walking into the gym, and there's Dr. Ken Cooper, who for however many years, he works out in the evening, and we sat there for 5 minutes, and he's 92, about to be 93, and just a model of consistency. So talking about rolling in, there's Ken Cooper, Dr. Ken Cooper, still just making it happen every single day. And you just said that they've had an impact on your journey in life.
Yeah, I mean, if you're from Dallas, you know that the Cooper Institute is legendary, but the first personal training certification I went through was through Cooper.
No way.
Yeah. And when I heard that.
Did you wear the all black? Did you ever train there? No,
I didn't train, but.
You just got, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this was 2002, so yeah. Some time ago. But, you know, talking about Dr. Cooper and even Scott, I think when I first got into fitness, it was all about, which I think is pretty typical, like short term performance, and you're not thinking about tomorrow, but it's like how challenging can you make something, how stimulating can you make a training session. But I would say Dr. Cooper's a great example. I would put Scott in that, even though there's, you know, decades upon decades. I think of Scott as a contemporary of mine, not someone that's much older, but I look at Scott and
but you are much older.
Did we have to go there already? Like
I think the camera can tell.
I think those examples tell you, like, man, the things that you're doing today need to set up for success so that you can be active like all throughout your life. And yeah, Scott's been a great example to me as well.
I think about this, the statement that I made to you about, as long as Spencer has a gym, I'm going to go work out there. And part of that is because of the way the training is set up. And it hasn't always been that way.
Yeah.
Like there was, what year did you open?
2008.
First CrossFit. Like, you know, back then it was kind of like you go in and you work hard and, you know, the intention wasn't to get hurt, but a lot of people got hurt because it was just, you were lifting heavy weights and a lot of people didn't know what they were doing and they hadn't worked out for a long time. It is completely different today than it was in 2008. And it is all about this idea of building the entire self,
yeah,
right? Physically and mentally too, in terms of where you guys are headed. But like one of the things that I do to just sort of check myself is what hurts today? Like what's broken? What hurts? You know, do my shoulders hurt? Do my hips hurt? Had a little bout of plantar fasciitis recently. I'm kind of over that now, but it's like, what hurts? And more days than not, nothing hurts. Like I'm sore, just like because you're exercising and you're working out and you're creating stress on your body, which is healthy, but nothing is broken. And I think it's attributable to what you guys are doing with the programming because you're so intentional about progressive loading and, you know, the sequencing of an 8-week build or a 12-week build and then doing a reset. And so it's very, I mean, they're just so careful and thoughtful about what they're doing. I mean, there's no place like it. And then from time to time I'll miss because I have to sleep in or schedule, you know, messes me up. And so I'll go to a more traditional gym to get my workout in. And I'm like, I just can't do it. I can't do it. I don't get as good a workout, you know? So I think there is something to the group setting where you're going to be more challenged. But I just, you know, the refrigerated towels that you get, you know, when you arrive at the gym.
Now, there's the Scott that we all know and love right there. There has to be an ounce of bouginess.
No.
So the refrigerated towels.
No, he's saying he doesn't need it.
That's a problem. Like, you go to that place and you're like, you don't even feel like you're really doing the work, you know, versus... at BPR.
Yeah, they've made it. Okay, I like that.
And you know, like today versus 15 years ago, it's not about how much weight can I move around. It's really about how can I feel great on a day-to-day basis, and then how can I take feeling great into the other areas of my life that I enjoy, whether it be surfing or snow skiing. Or I had this epiphany recently that I shared with Spencer. I surfed over the holidays. And normally, if you live in Dallas and you surf a couple times a year, the paddling is, you don't have any paddling endurance whatsoever. And on this particular trip, I had more paddling endurance than I've ever had. And I was like, okay, what have I been doing? And we have a ski erg at BPR, and the ski erg is basically an upright rower. So it's like the cross, emulates the cross-country motion of cross-country skiing. And I'd been doing that a bunch in the fall, and I have to think that's it, right? So if I can go here and it equips me to go do all the other things in my life that I love to do, and I can do that well into my 70s, maybe 80s, maybe I can be Ken Cooper one day at 93, and then that's all a really good thing.
Started this with health coach. Mm-hmm. And unpack that a little bit.
I wouldn't have always called myself that. I love the term coaching in general. Not to dork out too much, but that term originally meant, it was used as slang a long time ago. It was what you referred to a tutor. It literally meant to carry the student through a course. So a long time ago, coaching meant, you know, that you basically like did everything for the person that you
might
were.
Might have been derogatory time.
Yeah. And, you know, over time, it got reappropriated to mean, you know, something athletically. Or I think the word of that is much more noble now that you're coming alongside someone in some capacity with, you know, whether it's fitness or executive coaching. And, you know, we can get into that more about, you know, what specifically coaching should look like. But when I first started, it was purely about performance. And as Scott alluded to, you know, after lots of mistakes and lots of observations, you realize that most things in life operate as a part of a system. Fitness is one of those. And there's some aspects of that are obvious, right? If you do anything for long enough in the world of fitness, nutrition will come up, right? So it's very clear that there's some correlation to what I eat and then how I perform. But the longer I do this, I realize that there's a much more broad territory for fitness than we initially realize. So in the early days, it was like, man, how hard can we make the workouts? So in other words, it was what's the maximum dose that we can give somebody. And the longer that I do this, the more I appreciate that fitness is a part. And if it's a machine, it's probably a really big cog. I'm a little biased towards that.
Yep.
But there are things like sleep that Scott mentioned that at this point in time, I would rather Scott sleep in than come do a hard workout. If that's the thing that's in limited supply.
Which I did this morning, by the way.
Yeah, proud of you. So when you have that set of optics, you realize that, like, man, fitness is important, but it shouldn't ever supersede the other areas of your life. And so I call myself a health coach now because I want to always remind myself that if we create some response for this one thing, it better work within this whole system.
There's so much wisdom in what you just said, because it means you backed away from the one isolated thing and you just said, I'm looking at your entire health. And I would imagine you mean physical, mental, spiritual, everything. But what a great phrase. If he's in short supply of rest, get rest over a workout today. Go.
Take us back to the beginning. Where are you from? And, you know, where'd you grow up? And brothers and sisters and early childhood memories and kind of the arc of how we ended up here is kind of where we're going.
And how do you encapsulate yourself? But I think in the context of what we're talking about, there's a part now as a father where I see kids are grasping for identity. They're grasping for things that they can latch onto, where they say, "Hey, maybe this is an essence of how God made me. Maybe this is a part of who I am." And very early on, I knew two things. One, I was told that I was smart, and I was never told that I was athletic.
And this is by your mom and dad.
Yeah, and you know, and friends. Just, yeah, okay, yeah. So a lot of encouragement from my parents. Like, hey, they figured out that I was relatively bright, and so I really latched on to that. But athletics was never promoted, and so as I got to high school, like, I prided myself on certain things, but there were some areas that I was very insecure about. One of which being anything that was athletic. I played some tennis, but I had some really bad allergies and asthma growing up. And so, like, things like, well, anything that involved running was just not very logical for me.
Interesting.
As I applied to colleges, I was like, well, I'll do this based on, you know, my academics. And I applied to two schools. I applied to the Naval Academy because I had some family that was in the military and they had gone there. And I applied to Stanford. And Stanford, I didn't get accepted. But to the Naval Academy, I got what's called a congressional appointment, which is hard to do if you're, you know, not familiar with the military.
Yeah, academies. I'd like to, both of your places you applied,
pretty audacious.
Yeah. Super audacious.
Don't know what you don't know at 17.
Not like North Texas or Texas State. No offense.
Shooting for the stars.
Where are you from? Are you from Dallas?
I'm from Terrell originally.
No way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You've been to Lee Silver Fox? Is it still there?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if it's still there. But
I'm from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I moved to Dallas in 1988. Lee Silver Fox was the first place I went kicker dancing.
Uh-huh.
Lee Silver Fox. And I learned all Texans drive F-150s and they all back them up around the square box.
We call that a quick getaway.
Yeah, you know, well, that's why.
Uh-huh.
So when you steal somebody's you never know when you got a jam. So you're from Terrell.
From Terrell.
Yeah.
I got accepted, had great test scores, was good academically. But for the service academies, you have to take a physical. There's a physical aptitude test. And it was the first time I had ever attempted to run a mile.
No way.
And I remember being out at the track at SMU, and it was a rainy day. And my dad was out there with me. And I knew that when I finished that I was not going to the Naval Academy, which had been my dream. You know, yep. Stanford was kind of a pipe dream, but I really, really put a lot of effort into this. And so as a backup, you can enroll in another ROTC program and almost have like a backdoor entrance to the service academies. So because of my grades, I was automatically accepted to A&M. And I was like, oh, well, I'll just join the Corps. And being wildly unprepared for what I was going into, it was a rough first year. That first year, you get up every morning and you do a formation run. And I couldn't keep up. I fell out every single time. Huh. And so they put me in this remedial PT group. Was basically, and I'll just call a spade, it was a bunch of really overweight people and me.
And you.
And so I share all this with you because at that point, it was like, man, I've got to do something about this. I've prided myself on certain things, and this isn't going to alleviate this pain that I was feeling.
Yeah, I'm failing over here.
Yeah,
in effect.
Yeah,
and are you getting into? Are you feeling shame? And is that tapping in major league into your insecurity? How are you fighting all that emotionally, or what's going on emotionally in that?
It was a rough time. I remember having a shaved head with this stinky uniform on. It had just rained, and I got braces. I'm a freshman in college. And I remember wiping, you know, the rain off in the bathroom and just looking at myself and be like, man, remember this time.
I really can only go one direction. Yeah.
So it was at that point, I was like, I've got to figure this out. And fortunately, and I'm so thankful for this, strength conditioning, fitness, it's very formulaic. Now, like we said, there's a much broader system and there's some nuance and there's some complexity. But if you reduce it down to you can't run and you need to be able to run, fortunately, it's very basic arithmetic. You start with where you're at and you progress. And when I realized that this was a problem to be solved, I got excited because I like solving problems. And so at first, this was a huge insecurity. And yeah, to answer your question, Doug, like every morning it was just like shame, shame, shame. But this insecurity became something that I did progress in. You know, a little fact that I think is important is I was also a very late bloomer. And so as I was going through this experience as a freshman in college, I was also still growing. I was still developing. And so I'm very thankful that happened, that I figured some things out. And then this thing that was an insecurity turned into a very, very interesting subject and problem to solve. And then, you know, over time, it became something that I was like really passionate about. And I remember where I was, where I was like, this thing of fitness, I will be interested in this for the rest of my life. And,
Where were you?
I was in Sugar Land, Texas. Mm-hmm. And my first job, so to speak, out of college was working at a sport performance place called Plex. And I just remember digging into Soviet Union handbooks that had been translated that were showing like these linear progressions for strength training and just being like enraptured with this knowledge and thinking, mm-hmm. Oh, I'm ruined. Like I'm going to be looking at this for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of holes there, but you know, coming from that place, I think it's important always to communicate that a lot of people in fitness, you can assume like, oh, well, this has just been something that, you know, was gifted to you from the gods. And it's like, well, no, it's actually the exact opposite.
Yeah. Well, and I want to, because I'll forget it. And Scott, maybe you commented on as well, as far as leaders go. I heard two profound things you said there, Spencer, was problem to be solved. Mm. And start where you are and progress from there. I just think, yeah, speak to those things.
Have this weird conundrum. We have access to our own brains. We have access to our own thoughts. But yet when we see other people, you only have access to their actions and the outward manifestation of who they are. I think it's very easy for us to think that everyone has it figured out, but that we don't. Mm. And in reality, everybody, I like to say everybody gets the smoke. Everybody has a problem to solve. Now, what my problem to solve is now different than it was at 18, mm-hmm. but I don't get to go through this human experience getting or arriving at this point where it's easy street. There's always something mm-hmm. that's in limited supply. And that can sound, at least at first, pessimistic, but I think it's just realistic.
Yes.
And I have this conversation all the time with our young coaches and with members, and it's, I think it's a part of the depravity of man that we arrive at this place where we think like, man, if I can just get there, paradise is on the other side. And if we can just set ourselves up for a lifetime of growth, a lifetime of development, a lifetime of solving problems, I think we can be on this really exciting and adventurous journey of always having our eyes on a landscape view of like, okay, what's next? Like, what does God have for me? Okay, I did a little bit better here. I got to be a little bit better runner. Oh, there's this next thing. And instead of it being pessimistic, I think it can be a really exciting, exciting like game to play with yourself.
Adventure.
Yeah.
One of the things I love about Spencer's story is he found fitness later, right? Mm-hmm. And he found this passion for fitness and health. And obviously today it's your vocation as well as, mm-hmm. you know, it's a personal interest, mm-hmm. but like inside that you have figured out, probably like a lot of people have not figured it out, that fitness and health unlocks human potential, right? And it has the ability to create this unlocking mechanism. When you feel great about yourself and you feel like you're showing up as your best self, your ability and your potential to go do great things is enhanced. If you don't feel great about yourself when you wake up in the morning, like it's going to be hard to perform at the highest level. And so having fitness as sort of this foundational thing is, I think, so powerful. And for me and in my life, and maybe it's why we relate so well, is, you know, we've talked about this before, but, you know, I was a chubby little kid. Mm-hmm. In fact, I ran into an old friend from high school recently, and he is married to a girl that I went to elementary and middle school and high school with. Mm-hmm. And he said, yeah, she always remembered you as this chubby little kid. And they're kind of like, and look at you now, you know? And I said, well, I was a chubby little kid. Yeah. And part of the reason I started exercising was because I was, you know, effectively bullied, mm-hmm. And made fun of. And I was like, well, we're not doing that anymore.
Yeah, that didn't feel good.
But it, so the motivation early on was not necessarily for the right reasons. But what I found was now like this foundational thing that's in my life that it'll be in my life until I'm not here, because it adds to life. Mm-hmm. And like with my children, I'm trying to emphasize with them without overdoing it the importance of exercise and yep. being healthy, and then how that translates to mental health
yep.
and showing up as your best self. So mm-hmm. I love the arc of your story, which is why I wanted you to spend a minute there.
Thank you. Yeah, and you know, I say like I fell in love with fitness. However, you know, I could say in 2009, I got tired of coaching the squat, right? I mean, I had coached it 1,000 times by then. And so even though
I got tired of the squat much earlier than you got tired of coaching it, much to the chagrin of my son-in-law who loves the squat.
I think for anybody that's in fitness, they get into it because it is a passion. Yeah. They're more or less a gym rat. And yeah. I think that we all have that in common.
Yeah.
But at some point you do have to make that transition that Scott said, where it's not really about the exercise. It's about serving people. It's about evoking this best version of them in all these different ways. And so, you know, if fitness was only exercise selection and you know, coaching biomechanics, I think I would have got burnt out a long time mm-hmm. ago. But this thing of serving people and having a vocation where my job is to try to bring out the best version of them, I'll be doing that as long as I live. I'll never get mm-hmm. tired of that. And I think I feel so lucky that that's like such an easy transition for mm-hmm. anybody that's in fitness, to think of this more as coaching the whole person versus, man, how entertaining can I make a workout?
The same workout.
Yeah.
And I want to get back to your arc in a second, but I want to give you a chance, Spencer, because I think it impacts, I know it impacts me. I think it impacts a lot of leaders. The second point was start where you are and make progress. Why is that so valuable?
I think you do have to radically accept reality. Without that, there isn't a metric to compare yourself.
Well said.
I think probably all of us have had some experience where the hippocampus of our brain registers something that we don't want to repeat, but without really trapping what that is, it's hard to know how to progress. So most of the time we want to avoid anything that's produced shame or insecurity. And it's like, hey, let's focus on the good. But to be radically honest with where you are is the only way that you can look back and celebrate how much progress you've had. And so that's a hard thing to do, to like face the pain. It's a hard thing to do, whether it's seemingly inconsequential, like, hey, your mile time is, you know, 20 minutes, to, hey, you're really not good at this thing that means a lot to you. But it's the only way, regardless if it's fitness or if it's some other aspect of who you are, it's the only way that you can celebrate some wins. So I think it's very easy to brush past that and to start to dig into the process or to have these aspirations of where you want to come. But us as humans are really bad at looking back and saying, I did that.
I just think this is so valuable, Spencer. Fear of failure, just the overwhelmness of getting started. I'm out of shape. I'm overweight. I have a smoke. I have an addiction, whatever. Just the fear of failure, I think, then stunts so many people to even attempt. Do you agree? And address that, because I think this is so valuable. Just getting started. I love your idea of radically facing the truth. Because leaders, it could be a toxic personality they have in the office place. It could be physical. You have health coached so many people. I'm sure you've had this conversation. What? Give me some pragmatic steps to get past that fear of failure or overwhelmness to get started.
A life in pursuit of being the best version of yourself it's unavoidable that there'll be some pain. I have a daughter who's 10 years old, and she came to me one morning, and this was early in the morning. She was like, hey, I'm thinking about what it is like to be an adult. What are some things that I should really think are important? And it's like, man, that's a hard question to answer.
Holy cow!
At 6 a.m.
You give her a pen and start writing books right now.
Well, at first, I think I answered it like anybody was, like, oh, well, you want to be happy, and you know, you want to find something fulfilling. And then the more I thought about it, I realized that I don't actually want my daughter to pursue happiness. Mm. And I know that sounds weird, but to have a purpose means that at some point you will have to face something and do something that is unpleasant. And so we, you know, at the level of a 10-year-old, we just talked about, like, man, if you really know why something's important, then you will lean into some things that are uncomfortable. And if that's true, and I believe that it is, then pain's unavoidable, but you have a choice. You can face something and it can be really acute and potentially more intense, or you can face that story for the next 30 years of your life that plays in the back of your head. So you don't get to avoid this. You just get to pick, is it now, or is it going to be this like little drip for the rest of your life? And then I think there's some misconceptions around failure. Fear. When you think about it, everybody has what's called imposter syndrome. But that seems like the most normal thing in the entire world, that you would feel inadequate when you don't know what you're doing. For me, I struggled with that for a long, long time. This fear of looking like a fool, of not knowing what I'm doing. And for a long time, coaching to me was this pursuit of becoming an expert. Because I thought if I had expert knowledge, then I could avoid this thing. But today, whenever I feel like I don't know what I'm doing, I tell myself that I'm on the right path. I tell myself, oh man, it means you're exactly where you're at the threshold of your capacity. Because if I felt like I knew everything, how would that be challenging? How would that be the pursuit of, like we talked about, this more dynamic version of who you are? So I've tried to flip that and be like, oh great, there's that feeling again. I don't know what I'm doing. That's exactly where I should be.
That's a huge mind shift.
Yeah.
Embracing that, I don't know what I'm doing. This is exciting.
The narrative that plays in our heads that will kill any progress is to say, I have to be an expert, or to say, I'm the only one that feels this way.
Or I have to have all the answers.
Yeah.
Or, you know, before I start something, I need to have.
Mm-hmm. And now as a coach, I want to show up. Sure. I have 20 years of technical knowledge about some specific topics.
Like the squat.
Like the squat. But as I'm sitting with a client, I want three things to happen. Mm. I want to make sure I ask the best questions I possibly can. I want to pull out the wisdom. I want to help that person access the wisdom that I believe they already have. If I were to sit with you, Doug, and I ask you the right questions, I know that you know what you need. And then lastly, my job is based on the experience I have to try to have a very practical and simple path forward that I can hold you accountable with. And that's way different than being an expert. That's way different than standing on a pulpit and be like, hey, you really should, you know, eat meat and veggies. And it's more like, hey, you know what to do. Yeah. Do you really want to do it? And let's be in cahoots on this path forward. That's way more exciting than being an expert. Or, you know, I think oftentimes coaching can be construed as like a cheerleader, where it's like, hey, let me be more excited about your life than you are.
Yep.
And I only know these things from doing it wrong for so long.
Well, I got to ask, what are some of the questions that you would ask?
If I don't know you from Adam, I got to get a good understanding of as many different facets of your life. Thought about this a lot. Mm. And I think there's six areas that I would want to have a very surface level understanding of who you are. There's some performance stuff, and those questions are actual data that we'll collect. And some of that is looking at like, man, in the context of just performance, what is the thing that would be in limited supply? As soon as I ask a question and you have an adequate answer, we're moving on. Mm. Because instead of thinking like, man, how deep can I go in this one area? Right. I've got to look at the broad landscape. Yeah. So there's some things from a performance standpoint that we want to understand, like range of motion. Hey, how can you stabilize your body? Do you have the ability to exchange gas in a way that we would say is healthy? And if there's any red flags, like, hey, we'll make a note of that. But outside of performance, I want to look at your psychology, and that specifically is how do you regulate emotions? What do you say when you talk to yourself? And then what is your purpose? Like, what's your self-awareness? Like, why are we even here? Like, what are some reasons that you have for being here? Mm. And if I ask that question, and they're like, yeah, that's a good question, then I know, like, hey, that's an area that we can investigate and try to figure that out.
Potentially in short supply. I love your phraseology there, Spencer. It's so quantitative in the sense that, oh, I could be in short supply of purpose. It's disarming. I just want to, I don't know how long you've used that, but I love that phraseology. I just think it's really, so many people, it disarms it. I'm in short. We obviously do a lot with business owners thinking about a potential exit. Many of them, we can name you 50, 100 stories right now, they were in short supply of purpose outside of the firm that they built. And so I love that.
I'm glad you brought that up, because if we're testing your VO2 max, that is quantifiable. But these other areas, they feel subjective. That's the whole reason that in psychology we created a Likert scale. You know, hey, on a scale of 1 to 10, how that exists, because it's a subjective thing that we're talking about in the first place. So these things, and what I tell our coaches and anybody that'll listen is we do have to reduce it down to something that's measurable, just to give us context, just to give us some framework to build upon. And so a lot of these things, like, you know, mindset or purpose, man, it's very qualitative, but to have some quantitative measure in there just gives us a starting point. So there's performance, there's psychology. And then the other things, we've all tried to put an S word to it, so it's easy to remember. Sleep, sustenance, or nutrition. The social aspect, which we found is absolutely crucial, and then stress. And interestingly enough, there's for many years, a study that comes out, it's called the Wellness Index, where they interview 40,000 people and they say, why do you exercise? And until the last couple of years, the answers that came out were very typical. Hey, I want to lose weight. Aesthetically, I want to look my best. And then, you know, longevity and vitality. But since COVID, the top two answers are stress reduction and my mental health.
Wow.
And that's radically different.
It is.
In the last 20 years of, you know, me kind of ad nauseum looking at this study. So I think stress management's a huge part. We ask questions pertaining to what are your strategies for how you anticipate stressful situations? What are your strategies for how you handle stress once you're in the midst of it? And then my favorite question is, how do you decompress? And what are the ways that you are allowing yourself to cope for a stressful situation? This is an area that we could potentially investigate, but they have to lead. So as we go through this, what I call a spirited inquiry, there's lots of things that come up. Like I said, everybody gets to smoke when we've made it this broad. But I don't want to go any deeper than that person's willing to go. And I think that's the hardest part of coaching, right? Even with your kids, right? We want them to be active. We want them to have a love for this stuff. But all I can do is ask good questions, model what I think is good behavior, and then just be along for the ride when they say, hey, Dad, I'm ready to do this. Be like, okay, cool, let's go for it. Most people aren't opting in to this type of coaching unless they've been through some tough times. If life is all sunshine and roses and something like this comes up and they haven't recognized that this is real, I can't go there with them. I can't go any deeper than they want to go. Which is, I think, that, like I said earlier, like one of the challenges of wanting desperately to serve people. But man, just like Christ says, it's like we knock on the door, it's there, but I you got to go in first. I'm right there with you, but you got to go in first.
And C.S. Lewis tells us that pain is God's megaphone to awaken a deaf soul.
That's good.
So
that's so good.
I got to go to a question. You brought it up because I have it written here on some notes. I think you say this: discipline and curiosity wipe the floor with motivation and inspiration. Remember saying that?
Yeah.
He says it often, actually.
He does?
Yes. Okay. You go on Mondays, you'll hear it from time to time.
I try to sneak a sermon in there.
Yeah.
When I can.
Don't sneak. Come through the front door.
I think that we are told that, and those other things are important, but you have to set behaviors and patterns before life becomes this complex and unexpected thing. Discipline, in my mind, is saying like, hey, this is the thing that I'm going to pursue, and you know, these are the ways that I'm going to do it, and this is the schedule. I think the curiosity part is just, I love learning. And so figuring out, man, how can I constantly be repositioning myself in this thing? So, okay, I learned about this. Okay, now I'll pivot and I'll go this direction. And I think compared to those other two things, it's a system that's more reliable than waiting for inspiration or waiting for yourself to be motivated. Motivation's important. I think those two things are vital, and I can look back at my own life and appreciate the times that I was inspired and I was really motivated because of something specific, but oftentimes those are fleeting, and I think these things you can hang your hat on for the rest of your life. Yeah.
You said it. I'm glad you said it, but fleeting is the word, right, that I would use. Yeah. You know, and motivation can be fleeting. Inspiration can be fleeting. Like for a time, like it can get you up in the morning, get you going, but it's that deeper purpose with the long view of, you know, why do the things that I do? And then purpose feeds discipline, because there's certain activities that are going to align with purpose, right? If my purpose is whatever to be, you know, to be healthy for a lifetime. Mm-hmm. If that's part of my purpose, then there's going to be disciplines that go along with that. And that's independent of how I feel on a given day, mm-hmm. how inspired I am, how mm-hmm. motivated I am. It's just, it's this foundational thing. And so that's the way I interpret
that. That's well said, Scott. Purpose produces discipline.
It goes back also to what you were saying earlier about the, you know, the, sort of the six areas that you sort of delve into. Mm-hmm. I think if someone shows up and they just want to look better, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely not.
They want to be healthier, mm-hmm. you know, more physically fit. There's nothing wrong with that, but that can lose its motivation over time. Well, okay, so all of a sudden now you look better. Now what?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Right, like, you know, and so delving into some of these other areas creates a longer, more sustainable commitment to what you're doing. And, you know, again, not to pick on the 08-09 CrossFit genre, but, you know, back then, you know, it was just, it was more about how much weight can we lift and how much volume can we put out in a 60-minute session. And it wasn't really about sustainability mm-hmm. of the athlete. You know, I think one of the things we learned back then was we're burning through people.
Yep.
Yeah.
And if, you know, like for me, I've said it now twice, but I'll go the rest of my life. And I think the programming is set up to allow me to do that.
Yep.
The CrossFit of the early days wasn't set up for sustainability over a lifetime.
It got wiser. It took feedback and it got better.
And that was no fault of anybody's. Well, it was just kind of the way the thing evolved.
Lifelong learner, be a learner.
I'm very aware that this message that means so much to me, I don't know how I would have received it at 22. I would like to believe that if I took a time machine and I, you know, gave this lecture to my 22-year-old self, I go, okay, cool. That's more than I thought. That's great. But I love and appreciate those that are just starting the journey where, like you said, like, hey, it's this one thing. It's mm-hmm. performance. Mm-hmm. Or, man, yeah, I don't feel great about myself, and now I want to feel better about myself. And so how can I just solely focus on losing weight and having a healthier body composition? I think that all of that is along this same trajectory. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very empathetic. I'm very patient to realize, like, man, I needed to figure this stuff out for me mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. that I had a framework that made sense so I could step in mm-hmm. and I could help people. But once again, I think that, like, I don't regret anything that happened. I don't regret 08, 09. I don't regret any of these experiences because I needed that. It was necessary for me. And I wish that I was better at understanding things theoretically without experiencing them first. But I'm very much needing to, like, get my hands dirty and try something and unfortunately figure things out, like, the hard way.
I think that's more common. I think you would probably agree. And if not, that's fine too. Most of us have to, we name this podcast decision points. We got to have some of those decision points. And most of those are typically touching a hot stove. But as you have said a couple of times, now we got to realize I may have to touch that stove again to some degree because not everything was bad. It was just painful. So I want to pause there for a second. I want to, you finish A&M. I want to know about, you're married, you have children. Talk to us about your family.
That's the best thing I got going for me.
You're right. And that's a wise person.
The best parts of my story is if I had have gone to the Naval Academy, I would not have met my wife. Mm. The luckiest thing that happened to me was meeting Kelly. And that was through friends that I was in the Corps with. Yep. So after I graduated, I met Kelly, and we have three wonderful girls. I was with my father-in-law last night, who I consider my adult father. And, you know, someone was asking me, like, how did you make great choices? And I look back and I think, like, most of the great things that happened to me were because I was in the right place at the right time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've worked hard, but it's like, man, everything that I think is good, I don't know if I get credit for. I think God was good to me. And so I think a big shift was becoming a father. Hmm. If I just have to explain this stuff to myself, It makes sense. But like I was saying earlier, when I got to explain it to a 10-year-old.
You got
to
pass it on.
Yeah. And, you know,
do
like.
Do you know it or not know it?
Yeah. And those little girls, they're not very impressed with their dad in a way that like my words don't mean as much as like what I'm showing them. You heard the low points of the story, but the truth is athletically, like I did figure some things out and I did get in better shape. And through CrossFit in the early years, there was an open tryout for the U.S. bobsled team. And this was my first year of marriage to Kel. And she's used to me going and being like, hey, I'm going to go run a half marathon. It's like, we haven't trained for it. It's like, I'll be fine. And so the first year,
similar conversations that I know I have with Carrie. So similar.
Our first anniversary was like, hey, let's go to Park City. Oh, yeah, while we're up there, I'll do like this little tryout. Anyways, in CrossFit, you find that there's a lot of things you're not very good at. But after enough iterations, you figure out like, hey, you know, there's a handful of things that you are decent at. And all these things on the combine, I was pretty good at.
Yeah, squat.
Squat, power clean, all that. Anyways, I tried out. I made the team.
Come on, what year is this?
This was after the 2010 Olympics. So I dabbled in it from 2010, 11, 12, and went out for the Olympic trials. Didn't make it, way more than I bargained for.
Yeah.
You know, I was just going to try out and then, you know, move on to the next thing. A year ago, I'm with my kids. I've never talked about this, right? But it's one of the ice storms, and we get a laundry basket out, and we're on the hill, and I put my hands on it and said, hey, you know, Dad used to be one of the best in the country at this. Thinking that that would get a response like, wow, Dad, you're amazing. And my five-year-old's like, hey, could you go ahead and push me down the hill? You know, like couldn't care less.
You were looking for them to ask a follow-up question.
Yeah. Wouldn't you like to know more about this? So all that to say that I think that kids have been a wonderful refining process for me on how to deliver information, how to set a good example, how to even reevaluate, like, man, what really is important? If it's not just for me and I have to communicate this for the next generation, like, what is life really about?
Yeah.
And so it has made me ask some much bigger questions than how much can I squat? Or they teach me that they're complex too. Mm. You know, back to when I was a kid, it was like, hey, you're the smart kid. It's like, well, all my kids are smart and they're all knuckleheads at the same time. All of my kids are athletic and all of them have some things that are challenging for them. And so I think to treat them as this complex person that has lots of sides to their personality. And the most interesting thing, and again, like my girls are so much younger than Scott's, but
because you're so much younger,
because I'm basically a child. Yeah. I mean, it's like, I'm so young. Scott's so old, is to start to, investigate like what they're going to gravitate towards. Mm-hmm. And we're just starting to figure that out. You know,
what are the ages currently?
10, 7, and 5.
Wow. Chaos. Beautiful chaos.
So good.
Where'd you and Kelly meet?
We met here in town.
What bar? What place? Come on.
We met at a house party.
Okay.
And this was right when I was like deep in fitness. And so my brother and I were there and the party was a little lame, like no furniture, we were just inside of
clearly
a house.
Clearly a dude's apartment.
Yeah.
Yeah, a house.
Totally. And we went outside and we started trying to do handstands because, you know, that's what we were into at the time.
What else would you do?
And Kelly was at the party and she was there with her entourage and they came outside and they were heckling us because, you know, we weren't great at what we were doing.
But you were getting their attention.
That's right.
Which was effective.
That's an important part of the story. And my brother and I, we challenged their crew, be like, think you can do it better? And I remember that Kelly had like a fancy shirt on and jeans and she didn't say anything, but she took her shoes off, she tucked her shirt in, and she popped it to a handstand without moving her hands, which I didn't know you could do. I didn't know that was even possible. And then, no words, she just walked off into the night. And
she knew she had you hooked immediately.
And it turns out she like lived down the street, but it was like, you know, very dramatic and, you know, all of this. And come to find out that
fireworks
like,
are going off.
Yeah, 100%.
Like, who is this girl? Come to find out like Kelly was a really talented gymnast and she was coaching gymnastics at the time. So I did the, you know, Facebook stalking, and then I was at another party, and I got a text from her friend through Kelly, and she's like, hey, come over. And I'm from Terrell, but I get this text, and I go from a very seedy part of town to Windsor Avenue in Highland Park, and I go to what I later find is Kelly's parents' house, and I go upstairs, and it's around Christmas time. Kelly's dad is in a tuxedo, and Kelly's mom has like a mink coat on, and I was like, "Where?" I have a shirt that has hot dogs on it. And it's like, "Where am I?
I've been
What's going on?" Yeah. And it turns out they were at like their one time a year like Christmas party, and you know they were dressed to the nines, which isn't typical, but I didn't know that at the time. So there was a. Those are my two favorite stories to tell about.
Spencer, that's incredible. A scenario, I want to go back to one of the things that you said since COVID, stress and mental health.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to pitch you a scenario. Someone watches this podcast with you and they meet you in an elevator and they say, Spencer, I'm getting ready to go to the 11th floor and I have one of the most stressful, intense meetings I've ever about to have to go into. And you got 2 minutes. How are you going to pragmatically coach someone to handle stress?
If we're in an elevator and I have that finite
amount of time,
I would say, tell me right quick what you feel like you really have control over, like truly have control over. They'll say that. Okay, great. What are some things that no matter how hard you try, you really don't directly influence the outcome of that? I would want them to answer that. And I'd say, as you're in this meeting, I want you to pay attention to the physiological signals from your body. More than likely, you will feel tense. More than likely, your breath will be trapped in your chest. And to alleviate that, I want you to, before you even go in there, give me a few deep breaths. There's a protocol that we could take them through. And then as you're in the meeting, remember what you can control. And as silly as this sounds, man, I want you just to breathe. Just breathe deep. Breath trapped in our chest, it's really hard to make good decisions. Parasympathetic breathing through our diaphragm with an understanding of, you know, we're not omnipotent. We can't read people's minds and we don't have control over everything is a much better strategy to successfully navigate like something that's not physically stressful, but psychologically stressful.
You've evolved from Dallas Central to now BPR. What's kind of your vision for the future and kind of where things are headed with what you're trying to do?
When we rebranded to behavior and performance research, it was this aspiration. Not claiming that we had all of that figured out, but it was this hope that in the direction that we were going, we could coach more and more of the person, that we would have a more realistic understanding of what their life looks like. And instead of showing up as an expert, show up as a trusted ally for this long-term relationship with the clients that we have. I'm so thankful that we figured some of that stuff out, and I'm very reluctant to say figured out, because I'm sure if this is the time capsule and we're watching this 10 years from now, I'd be like, man,
progress.
Yeah, that guy didn't know anything.
Progress.
But it's way better than where we came from.
Yep.
I think of the gym as this test kitchen, and unbeknownst to, you know, Scott and others, like it's some experimentation and it's trying some tools and, you know, saying something, seeing how it lands. And so I love that iterative process of experimentation.
Mm.
It's almost like a kitchen. It's almost like having this restaurant. And my job is to not be just good at what we do. I want to completely reinvent what it means to be a coach. And along those lines, I feel called to not just coach our clients, but to coach coaches. And I think for anybody that's in a leadership position, that's a natural evolution, that you would want to go from the ground level to then turning and sharing what you learned with other people that are younger, that are on the same trajectory, and be like, hey, if you do this, I think it'll go well for you. I think these will be some good tools. And so that's the path we're on. And 20 years later, I feel like I've just got it started with this. And man, I just feel so thankful to be doing what I'm doing And to get to work with people like Scott and others that, yeah, it's like such a, it's such an honor to serve.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I understand that you have a conversation, a talk. What's that rooted in? What's the why? What's the couple of pragmatic takeaways? What does life after success mean to you?
When I first met Kel, we were attempting to open the gym. And I remember sitting on the loading dock as we were like, you know, cleaning asbestos out of the, you know, roofs of that first building, drenched in, you know, something that has probably taken a few years off my life. And Kelly was there.
Sweat and asbestos.
Yeah. And I remember asking her, I was like, hey, I think I'm going to take a pretty unconventional route to what I want to do. Are you up for that? And to her credit, and it's one of Kelly's best qualities, she's like, yeah, I call her a ride or die chick. Hmm. And so if I suggest something to Kelly and she says no, I know it's a really bad idea.
Yeah.
Because she's up for most things.
That's an easy no.
It's an easy no. But I share that because we very intentionally, instead of saying like, well, if I can just be successful, then I can enjoy my life. We very intentionally are trying to live out this adventure that's balancing these two things, that I get to do something that I'm really passionate about. I don't have to create a separate vocation. I don't have to create a separate way of serving people. It's built into what I do. And so there are some things that I have set for myself that is a scoreboard. You know, there's things from a business standpoint and as a small business owner that I've set as metrics that I want to hit, but I'm under no illusion that by hitting those, I'll arrive at this point where I say, well, now it's easy street.
Mm-hmm.
I want to constantly be setting ambitious goals for myself that allow me to continue to expand who I am as a person. But, and this is difficult to do, but at the same time, Scott told me this, hey, when you coach Little League soccer, don't look back and be like, oh man, I wish I was still doing it. Like in the moment, do the best you can. Mm-hmm. So when you look back and be like, I don't want to go back there. I did the best that I could. Mm-hmm. So that's a paradox, but I'm trying to be ambitious, but at the same time, like just enjoy the heck out of what we're doing in the moment that we're doing it.
Well, I love about that. You have metrics. What are a couple of those metrics for your business?
Well, because we're in the service industry, there's specific things with clients. There's an average revenue per member. There's a length of engagement. In our industry, like those are tried and true metrics, and we're always trying to improve those. There's a churn rate that we're always paying attention to. And then, you know, bottom line, like I'd be lying to you if I said that the total revenue that we make each year, I'm a competitive person.
Yeah.
So it's a way that I'm competing with myself against myself. And so those things are always things that as a staff we're circling back to and we're looking at. I think qualitatively, I love being a boss. I love having a team. I love being able to instill hope. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the best things you can do as somebody that's in a leadership position. And I love being able to pour into those guys. And so I think that as they're more successful, so as I look at our coach's book of business or their individual metrics, as that goes up, it's an indication. It's like, man, we're on the right track.
That's good.
It's some of the support of the staff that you, just like we said earlier, like you try to quantify, even though it's more qualitative.
Mm-hmm.
And then just those numbers of the business too.
One of the things I love about BPR is, you know, you got a class at 5:30 in the morning, 6:30 in the morning, 7:30 in the morning, then they take a break till the afternoon, and then it's 4:30, 5:30. Is there a 6:30 p.m. or is it just 4:30?
Most days, yeah.
Most days. So six classes, they're all packed.
Yep.
Like you walk in there at 5:30 in the morning and there's 30, 40, 50 sometimes people in a class, repeated at 6:30, repeated at 7:30. All ages, all shapes and sizes, all fitness levels, some, you know, incredibly, incredible athletes in shape, peak performance, and some who are just getting started, overweight, doing this for the first time, and we're all in there together.
Mm-hmm.
And the community that you guys have created is really, really special.
And thank you.
Your coaches do an amazing job of, and it's because of your leadership, but your coaches do an amazing job of sort of, even though you're only there on Monday mornings.
Delegation.
Yes. I mean, you know,
build a bench.
You feel your presence even though you're not there, but you've created a really unique environment. And that's part of what I love about it.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Spencer, let's give you the final word. One of our favorite questions to ask leaders like yourself is, you got 1 to 3 minutes and there's a room of 100 CEOs. That's all you got. What are you going to give them?
I'm nervous to say something that I think is boring, but let's say that you're an accountant. I think there's still a very beautiful, noble purpose to that. When you think about the people that are around you that you get a chance to impact and that you lead, any job, regardless of what the specifics are, I think you can create and determine some very noble purposes around that. And I think once you can do that, then what you get to talk about as a leadership team, where you get to go as far as how you'll coach the younger members of your staff is no different than what I get to do. You want them to show up as your employees the strongest they possibly can be, so they can do the best job that they can. And so even though it feels very niche, these things that we're talking about with those six areas, my hope would be that every person in a leadership position can ask great questions, access the wisdom that their employees already have, and then hold them to this very practical and simple trajectory where they, through your business, can be the best version of themselves. And I think that if you do that, it will make them so beholden to you, there will be like this relationship that's not based on just the numbers, even though that's important. You will have figured out that this thing that we're doing through business has the most noble of purposes. And if you can figure that out, I think that instead of waiting until you're successful and waiting till there's an exit strategy, you can taste of that fruit as you're going through it.
Thank you for taking time to spend it with us. Spencer, thank you. Thanks for joining Decision Points.